answered. Assuming the MCB hasn't blocked your passport, I'll book a trip. Probably best to keep you out of MCB's eyesight for a while anyway. And we still need to get to the bottom of you being under investigation. I don't like it when they slander my people. I'll spread the word to be on the lookout for your idiot brother. Thank you. It was nice to have people at your back. Milo, I'll handle the teams killing these things. He rubbed his hands together with glee. Kill it with fire, he added with a mad cackle. Coordinate with Franklin. Hoodoo Squad's busy enough as it is, so we'll work the bait traps in when it's best for them. Earl cleared his throat. Now, I know everybody is excited, but you need to realize what we're up against here. I've fought creations of the old ones before. They're rare, and that's a blessing. I can't accentuate enough how serious this is. What the adjuster said about the radius? The more powerful servants of the old ones twist reality just by existing. The veil gets thin when they're around. I had briefed everyone else on my encounter with the powerful, maybe even master vampire during Mardi Gras. This must be the outsider Jack warned me about. Yep. This thing beneath us, it's why New Orleans is so fucked up. Why, every little wannabe chicken-shit witch doctor can suddenly raise the dead and create giant monsters, Earl growled. You got your assignments. We're gonna take our time, do this right, get our shit together, and kill this motherfucker dead. Get to work. I had to stick around for at least one Kifo kill. It was my idea, after all. And it turned out the puff was pretty damn decent. Milo and the teens were about to make a pretty penny off of giant slug monster barbecue. We carried the pig over in the team van. It was 200 pounds dressed weight. Serious porker. This time we were going back to Eagle Street. MCB had reluctantly accepted our argument that if it had a puff, we were allowed to kill it. But they'd insisted on evacuating the neighborhood and coming up with some bullshit cover story. I think it had to do with methane gas or something. The reason it was bullshit was New Orleans. Most here knew Hoodoo was real and serious. All you had to do was walk along the street banging on doors and saying, "Gonna be some serious Hoodoo. Bars won't help. Best get out." Of course, then there were the people who wanted to know what the government was gonna do for them. "Where's we gonna stay? You gotta put us up a hotel. And buy us a hot meal." Despite the diction, these were not entirely or even primarily one race. Just as every politician and city worker in New Orleans had a handout, every resident had one pointed straight at the government. Or so it generally seemed. Nobody seemed to want to take action for themselves. Mow a lawn? Somebody else's problem. Hoodoo crap on your driveway? What the government gonna do about that? I ain't cleaning it up. Hoodoo? Ain't my problem. I'd met decent, hard-working, law-abiding people in New Orleans. I'd met people who were willing to stand up and fight the good fight. I knew they existed. But Diogenes would have his work cut out for him in this place. I was fairly certain one of these days God would get so fed up with the hellhole, he'd go all Old Testament and bring down full-on biblical wrath. Back to killing things. We'd waited to pack and rig the pig until we had it in the building. Why? 200 pounds dressed weight and another 100 pounds of thermite, that's why. And since we were all boots and suspenders types when it came to explosions and arson, we didn't stop with just thermite and a fuse igniter. In the pig, along with all the thermite, were 3 detonation sequences, 1 electrical, 2 mechanical. "Oh, come on," I said. "I want to bring the worm up. I'm on a flight to England tonight. These things are super rare. This might be the only chance I'll get." "Fine, fine," Milo handed over the sprayer. "You can tickle its funny bone or whatever." More like whatever. I put on my respirator. "Fire in the hole." This time I was going to watch what happened through a window. Milo waited outside with me. Up came the blasphemous Kifo menu. It was still hard to look at, but I hung in there. It raged a bit until an edge of its loathsome body touched the pig. Then, in an instant, the porker was gone. It was hard to even see what happened, but it seemed to have just slid over it and engulfed the massive hog. The thing lumped around for a bit, looking for more snacks, then slid down into the hole, apparently satisfied with its offering. I could see one of the wires tighten, then slack, indicating it had pulled the appropriate pin. The wire with the electrical detonation sequence was spooling out like we'd caught a world-class marlin. Then the ground started to shake, and smoke began gushing out of the hole. "Oh, yeah!" I pumped my fist up and down. "Crispy Kiffo!" And then the worm, mortally wounded, came gushing back out of the hole. I thought it was ugly before. Now it was ugly and on fire. And very, very pissed. "Time to leave," I said, skipping away. "Tell me we have fire trucks standing by." "Look, it's dead," I said to Agent Robinson, standing by the smoldering and thoroughly destroyed house. "That's our job. Cleanup is yours." I was getting really tired of handcuffs. Chapter 5. "Dr. Rigby," I shook his hand when I arrived at the Institute. I knew I wasn't safe there from pursuit by the MCB, but there was a certain weight taken off my shoulders.
"Chad,"
Rigby waved me to one of the wing-back chairs in his office. The primary Institute offices were in a large Georgian mansion in Midsummer. Convenient to Oxford, and a bit less convenient to London, the estate was a useful place to train incoming monster hunters, as well as kick back and relax when things got a bit on the tough side. The grounds were pleasant and heavily warded. The local pub was good, and many of the locals had been read in on supernatural at one time or another. Rigby's office had large windows letting in pleasant English spring sunshine. I definitely was starting to feel my shoulders unwind. "Have you found anything more about the entity?" Tea had been laid out. English high tea was another thing I'd missed. Only the English could do scones.
"Nothing beyond the Ashanti reference," Rigby said, taking a bite of a scone. "We've scoured our archives and have a team looking at Oxford."
The Puff Adjuster said that they were only known in West Africa, northwestern Mongolia, and interior Indonesia. The only area that's been extensively studied by English ethnologists of those three is Africa.
"A point we're discovering," Rigby said. "But there has been very little formal research into Mongolia or Indonesia, at least the interior. The Dutch did some work on coastal areas. You should look into pre-Enlightenment archives from those areas. I believe Oxford has many from the Chinese as well as extensive records from the Indians. Alas, mostly untranslated from a variety of different languages and dialects, many of which are lost."
"Fortunately, I'm good with languages." I shrugged. "I'm going to just do research for a while and hope that I can come up with something." The Puff Adjuster definitely knew more than he was telling.
"They always do," Rigby said with a sigh. "I've only dealt with the American adjusters 3 times in my entire career. They are the independent oversight over the Puff program, I've been told. It's a very small, secretive, and select group, which requires a certain kind of expertise."
I didn't really get the feeling he was a saint. I shook my head. But he certainly was odd.
"Which one was it?"
"Coslow?"
"Ah, yes." Rigby winced. "Dealt with him when I was a junior operative. Taught me to mind my P's and Q's, I'll say that. Do not waste his time. He becomes rather surly. However, enough about our mysterious worm for now. Since we are together and not speaking over a potentially wiretapped line, it is time to dwell on the MCB believing you are in league with a death cult."
"I'm not."
"If I thought for the briefest moment you were, we would not be having this meeting. The MCB's findings are rubbish. I spoke to some of my contacts at MI4 based on your information. They're not willing to get involved. Not worth their time. But they did confirm that the information came from a reading and that it indicated you were the Alpha and Omega of this sacrifice-selling ring. I certainly didn't start it, but I'd be more than willing to end it. Did they vouchsafe the nature of this casting? They did not. Rigby shrugged. The one contact who was most open said he was unaware of the details. But he also said you and your brother were entwined in the matter supernaturally. Fated as Cain and Abel was the exact quote he'd been given. I pointed out that could have myriad interpretations. I think MI4 is humoring them. But since you were still allowed in the country, at this point I don't think anyone on this side of the pond thinks you're a culprit. I've got people asking around, trying to find my brother, but he's gone off the grid. Once he's found, we're going to have a little talk. Having a family member fall in with dark forces is a terrible thing. Are you prepared for the repercussions? I snorted. Rigby nodded thoughtfully. Very well, then. Personal history aside, please refrain from jumping to conclusions. That would make you no different than the MCB. The meaning of this reading could be something a bit more complex. I hate the complicated hoodoo. I frowned. I like the big stuff you can shoot. Don't we all, lad? Don't we all? So, you are off to research your menacing Kifo?
Definitely, I said. I always feel like a salmon returning to its stream there.
They go to those streams to mate and die, Chad.
Ever seen the girls at Oxford, Doctor? I asked, smiling. I'll just have to avoid the die part. The main Oxford library was well known to visitors. They even had tours. Not at this point the largest library in the world, it was nonetheless extensive, and its rare books collection was one of the finest in the world. There were Marlowe manuscripts from the time of Shakespeare, original Dickens first drafts, and rare scrolls from the time of the Library of Alexandria. What was less well known to all but the most stringent researchers were the many supplementary libraries scattered around the town. Most of those were designated to specific areas. One was devoted solely to anthropology, another to linguistics, still others to math and sciences. Those held an enormous amount of information garnered over the centuries. What a select few people knew about was tucked away in Summertown, mostly under an unpretentious and not particularly large manse, was the Library for the Study of the Supernatural and Occult, a.k.a. the Unseen Library. On the surface, it was, again, a very small place. The building was 3 stories and about 10,000 feet. In the various rooms were many general works of the occult. Books about the supernatural you could find, with some looking, in any standard library. But take the side door into the basement. Show your ID to the nice librarian with the subgun behind the desk, and you entered the real library. It was an unknown number of stories deep. The deeper the level, the higher the clearance needed from the BSS to enter, and the guards here were polite, professional, and ready to kill anybody. As a visiting scholar, I was only allowed access to the first 2 floors. Supposedly there was a copy here of every book, manuscript, scroll, and tattooed flesh chunk with supernatural information on it ever discovered by the British Empire. It was rumored that the lower levels had vaults containing the most powerful of grimoires, original copies of the Necronomicon, Das Rad der Zeit, the Cloyha na Coronach, and other works so deep and evil, I wasn't even sure of their names. They kept the books in Oxford. They kept the artifacts in London. However, since there had been an incident involving a mummy and a rogue MI4 operative, that collection had been closed to scholars. Or at least that's what the VHI people told me over drinks. I started in the Oriental sector and dove in. I was up on Hindi and sort of familiar with Cantonese. I quickly discovered that wasn't going to be enough. Most of the texts held there were not only in other languages, they were in obscure dialects thereof. It was in a scroll written by a Gujarat yogi and traveler that I found the first reference to the Mavapanava. The traveler, one Shundar Drupada, had studied the magic of the Hulan Talangio. He described a similar sacrifice to the Ashanti, as well as great power over the dead. However, the Hulan Talangio wizards were more knowledgeable of the beast he called the Mavapanava, which translated in Gujarat as Mother Worm. They knew what they were sacrificing to was simply an extension of the great worm which lay below, but exactly where below was unclear. The text spoke in increasingly shrill tones of subterranean horrors that lingered beneath the earth. He listed dozens, including the well-known Shuggoth, Grinders, and something I'd never heard of called the Antarika Pavitra Karatame Tum Grinjanaka Rieksana Dharmanda, which he appeared to find the most horrible of all. The book eventually drifted off into mad ravings. Even figuring out who the Hulan Talangio were took a few days, as there were no other references to them. I went back to the main library, then the ethnology library, and finally found a reference to a Dutch punitive expedition which had been sent into a department of the Indonesian territories to deal with a tribe that were slave traders, cannibals, and workers of black magic. They had destroyed their unclean altars and their black deity and returned to Jakarta with heavy losses. But nowhere in the libraries was there an original report from the expedition, just a report of heavy losses fighting the unclean forces of the dark god, and no description of how to destroy the dark god, presumably the Mavapanava. Or it was possible they just destroyed the Kifo pseudopods, in which case the damned Mava was still there. I checked Oxford's references, and if there was an extant original report, they couldn't find it, not even through the Dutch. Stuff got lost over the years. I did find one other item, which was an early news report, in Dutch, that spoke of the walking dead attacking the expedition. Okay, so the local hoodoo used shamblers. Good to know. West Africa, there was only the Ashanti report. That was it for Indonesia. That only left Mongolia. I searched for a week, during which there was no sign of my brother, but Milo torched a few more kifos, before finding a reference in a decayed scroll seized from the Imperial Library in China during the Boxer Rebellion. According to the documents, the scroll and numerous others were taken as loot by a hunter who was at the time a major in the British infantry. He had recognized the scrolls as containing supernatural information and, rather than have them be destroyed or end up in some other officer's library, had traded two Ming vases for them. The very decayed scroll was in the dialect of the Eastern Jin dynasty, dating it to between 317 AD and 420 AD. It spoke of a punitive expedition against a mystical force which went deep into Hun territory north of the Great Wall. The expedition was ordered by the Light of Heaven for infractions against the Order of the Heavens. This generally meant really black magic. The Huns were not the culprits. They were much more fearful of magic than the Chinese. The culprit was a foreign, did not say what nation, alchemist. He had raised a great dark god in the Hulun Bear region. This dark god was in turn bringing all manner of dead things back to life, such that the alchemist had a vast army of the undead with which he planned to unseat the Son of Heaven from his throne and bring all of China into a long night of dark magics. At least, that was what I could get from the fragments of the scroll. What happened was unclear. The scroll was very degraded. It looked as if, with the allowance and even support of the Huns, a General Kong Li Rong led a large expedition deep into the arid wastes of the Hulun Bear. Only a fragment of the force returned, bearing the beheaded body of their general. The great evil had been defeated and destroyed utterly by the alchemists of the emperor, but none of them had survived either. The general had ordered that all the fallen were to be beheaded, and in most cases their bodies burned. It was in pieces, and I had to guess as to the meaning of some of the pictograms. Pictograms are always more of a by-guess and by-gosh thing, but in this case it was worse. They were barely legible. Most of them were half-eaten away, and a single pictogram of the period could have a dozen meanings. As an example, the pictogram for water could, depending on variables, mean water in general, rain, a spring, being transparent, being opaque, a lake, an ocean, a river, etc. But the sole useful reference was to mining/digging/boring/tunneling to the darkness/deeps/cavern/hole in the ground, and bringing to the darkness/etc. the powder/ash/sand/dust of the sun/fire/volcano. The reason for the slash is that any of the preceding meanings would hold for what I was pretty sure were the pictograms. Ancient languages, frankly, suck. What that probably meant was what made sense. Find the worm body, dig down to it, and burn it with alchemical fire. The Chinese of that period knew not only the making of gunpowder, but various other fast-burning chemicals. I checked, and they even knew how to make an early version of thermite. However, the alchemical fire was of no use, so they called upon a mystic to fight the beast. The pictogram for that could mean alchemist, wizard, sorcerer, or certain categories of priests, including Tibetan or Ainu shamans. Then they attacked it with materials which were known only to them. That damaged the beast, possibly killed it. Alas, the bit about what happened after that was the most degraded. The main noticeable bit was that the writing changed. The writing up to that point had been in one hand, then changed to a less capable hand. The scroll was marked with the chop of the scribe to General Kong Li Rong at the beginning. The latter chop was of a lesser scribe, and it was in part his less capable writing as well as preparation of the inks that made the rest of the scroll pretty much useless. There was a list of casualties that appeared to be long to the extent it could be read, and the writing to that point was more or less a log by the general. After that, it was by a Captain Tai Bo Li. But how the general had died and why a lesser captain was now in charge of the remnant force was missing or illegible. The main battle seemed to have taken place after they got down to the Mavapanava. That was worthwhile to know. As it turned out, it was pretty much the most important thing to know. There also wasn't a single reference on how to find the damn thing. I went searching for anything I could find about General Kong Li Rong or Captain Tai, but there wasn't much. The problem was that every dynasty in the long history of China had at one point or another tried to erase prior history so as to make themselves look more important. Mao's destruction of religious texts and historical documents during his reign was simply a continuation of a very long process. Most Chinese history depended upon secondary sourcing and remembered details, and was thus extremely suspect. General Kong had had an illustrious career to that point, and his death was noted in remnant imperial archives. He was laid in state with great honors and guaranteed a position in heaven. Captain Tai was promoted to general for his exploits, unspecified in other documents, and also went on to great things. But there was no further information about the lost expedition. There were no references to which alchemists they had brought with them to fight the Mavapanava, nor what mystic stuff they used. I talked to a professor who was a specialist in the period, and he really had nothing to add. He'd never read that particular scroll and did find it fascinating. Since he wasn't read in on supernatural, he saw it as just another punitive expedition of an evil empire oppressing the poor herders and farmers of the region who, based upon the Great Mother being, were probably matriarchal and... Could we get back to the point? Were there any extant writings by alchemists of the period?
There were.
The particular emperor of that period was a proponent of Tibetan alchemists, and had filled his court with useless soothsayers and shamans from Tibet, instead of spending the money on the poor and downtrodden people of...
Gah! Not ancient Tibetan.
Ancient Tibetan is the worst ancient language ever. Except maybe Coptic. In both cases, all the words are suppositional, meaning they are dependent upon other information in the text and outside of the text, and the Tibetans, for religious reasons, absolutely opposed direct description of anything abhorrent or unclean. They wouldn't even directly describe poisons. To explain, when it came to anything bad or unwholesome, the ancient Tibetans were more politically correct than a Harvard academic. They were so into euphemisms it was insane. Example, the Tibetans wrote many books about medicine. Say that they are describing the symptoms of cyanide poisoning. They would describe the symptoms, bluing of the lips, fingertips, and tongue. But when they got to the cause, the cause of this malady is that which is of the fire of Deva, which is of the dust of Shetal, that which is of the path of the heron. You would have to then go try to find something that explained what that meant, problem being that it was invariably word of mouth and very closed even then. A junior doctor might look up the text and find that the malady was described, but would have to go to a more senior lama or shaman to ask what the hell that which is of the fire of Deva was. Because you didn't get to learn about poisons until you were a trusted fourth dong or something. And even then it was hierarchical. Sort of like MCB, come to think of it. Everything unclean was classified. Since most of the senior lamas and shamans, who knew what all the classified euphemisms meant, had been killed by the Chinese communists in the takeover of Tibet for being, you know, lamas and shamans, and thus unclean in the eyes of communists, most of the really hard information a hunter needed had been lost. Also, the way the writing is laid out has always made my brain ache, and I'm good with cuneiform and Sanskrit. Ancient Tibetan? Hate it. I should probably add an explanation. As noted previously, every time the Chinese went through a major civil war, which was frequent in their history, the winners would try to get rid of history and were in many cases very thorough about it. This isn't a purely Chinese thing. The Mayans and Byzantines did much the same thing. Try to find specific details about Jeshua, a carpenter of Nazareth sometime. You'll find references to references. You can find his name in indexes of tax records, for example, but all the original references are missing. Why? Byzantines collected them all up and either hid or destroyed them. The Tibetans never really had a civil war, so their written knowledge had been preserved for thousands of years continuously. It was nearly impossible to decipher, but it had been preserved. That was until the fucking Chicoms came along and destroyed it. Fuckers. I might hate ancient Tibetan, but I hate book burners more. I reminded myself that at least it wasn't Coptic and dug into the texts that were available from the period. Oddly enough, most of those were in the regular Tibetan section. I'd used those libraries extensively when studying Yeti, so they were familiar stomping grounds. It was well known that the supernatural didn't exist, and all these references to demons, Yeti, and walking dead were just superstitious nonsense. And since the Tibetans were so oblique in everything they wrote, it was nearly impossible to glean actual incantations, spells, demonic names, etc. All those details were handed down by word of mouth, and unless the Dalai Lama knew them, they were lost to time. So the writings, unlike that of medieval alchemists, Islamic Sufis, and Hindi yogis, were harmless enough. You had to really know your stuff to get anything out of them. The other problem is that Tibetans had all sorts of references to call it what lies beneath. In their mystical pantheon, hell isn't that far down in the ground. Miners and farmers are tightly bound to the wheel by the fact that both dig in the ground, which is, in and of itself, unclean. And they firmly believe that there are monsters absolutely riddling the crust of the earth. Drop a shovel, and you're going to hit some demon or other eldritch thing. They were especially scared shitless of some buried sleeping monster called Unbinder of the Path and Unmaker of All Things. So, finding a reference to one particular monster in underground Mongolia was tough. They also had very little concept of geography outside of Tibet. The Chinese may be described as insular, but it's nothing compared to classic Tibetans. If it wasn't in Tibet, it didn't really exist. And if it was in Tibet, its location was described the same way a small-town resident would describe a location. Up the valley where Tom used to live, take a left where his house used to be, walk 19 paces of the length of the most illustrious lotus, dig down about as tall as Adam, who lives over in the next valley, and you'll find the Eater of Air. Never try to follow a Tibetan treasure map. I finally found a third or fourth-hand story that seemed to match the datum. A major lama of great alchemical knowledge had been engaged by a king of the lower lands, to the Chinese the son of heaven, to the Tibetans of the period nearly as important as a rich farmer, to accompany an expedition to fight a great evil. This evil, like most evils in Tibetan hoodoo, was found to exist at a great depth. The user thereof was a sorcerer of lands to the west beyond the enlightenment of the Buddha, which could mean anything from the Persian Empire westward. There were some problems getting to the location of the beast. Battles didn't really matter to the Tibetans, but the Lama had used the power of the peace of Buddha to put most of those to rest. Then he cast the Rune of Onesh to determine the location of the Foul One. After it was positively located, ones who plumb the depths for riches at loss to their soul upon the wheel, miners in other words, were summoned to dig down to the depths to find this foul beast. This took more than 10 cycles of the moon, during which time the Lama was also said to have cured many illnesses, including, most notably, blindness, brought people fully back from the dead, and summoned a great chariot of fire from the sky to ride about doing good deeds. Given my job, I wasn't sure which bits were entirely made up and which bits were pure history. The Mava was described in detail. I mean, really extreme detail. Went on for a page and a half. Problem being, it was all in nearly impenetrable euphemisms. The body was of the crown slash head slash sun slash light slash helmet of the most enlightened. There were many of that which is of the high slash airy slash well-loved slash most holy places. However, the horror of the sight of the thing came through even with all the euphemisms and the ancient Tibetan. Once the foul body of the beast was exposed, pathetic and useless alchemists of the lowlands, Chinese in other words, tried various forms of their alchemy and magic to attack the beast, to no avail. Many were lost in battling it. The Lama was persuaded to take a hand and laid unguents upon it and certain rare alchemical materials. This caused the beast great harm, and it, in turn, reacted by summoning its servants from the unclean earth. What the servants were was unclear. It was assumed you'd know what the servants of the beast were, so what were they? The Khifo worm pseudopods? Shoggoths? Grinders? Homunculi? There were many of the servants described, but without that word-of-mouth knowledge, you really got bupkis. Exact description was forbidden. Damn ancient Tibetans. The Lama again brought the piece of Buddha to many of them, but it was insufficient. The beast was pushing back, and even the power of Buddha has limits. Many of the rest of the expedition fell and even became servants slash sacrifices slash monsters to slash of the great beast. But in time they were defeated, as was the foul beast. The Lama perished in battle, along with many lesser souls, you know, those bound upon the wheel lowlanders, i.e. Chinese. But the story was brought back by his apprentice, and thus it is written, I shall bow to the four winds. So, you find this great worm mother using the rune of Onesh. Dig down to it. We could probably drill these days. Lots of oil drilling in Louisiana. Hit it with some sort of mystic unguents. That may not kill it right away. Then it brings its servants to attack you. The servants were probably the Kifo worms. Fire for those, bring flamethrowers. It looked as if the Chinese expedition had lost about 5,000 people fighting this thing. They didn't have flamethrowers and good explosives, so I was pretty sure we could keep the casualties under 5,000. The rune of Onesh was surprisingly easy to find. It had been written about any number of times. This rune was inscribed on a jade pendant, which was then enchanted, and it basically pointed toward certain types of evil, primarily undead, but it sounded like basically anything with the stink of the old ones on it. I hadn't been aware of the rune, but it sounded useful as hell as long as it worked for someone other than a Buddhist Lama. And if they were the only ones who could use it, I knew where to find dozens of Lamas in the U.S. Some of them might even be able to translate the rare unguents and alchemical stuff. On a tip from Rigby, I ran down to London and some of the alleyways behind Portobello Road and picked up an authentic rune of Onesh pretty quickly and surprisingly cheap. It appeared fairly old, and I suspected it might have fallen into the shopkeeper's hands after falling out of the back of a truck. Given that whoever the previous owner was, they probably had no clue of its use or its value, I could live with that. I didn't bother to go to Chinatown to see what I could dig up about alchemical materials. The Chinese ones hadn't worked anyway, and they'd ended up using fire. If this thing was as big as the puff adjuster suggested, we'd probably need quite a bit of thermite. Maybe magnesium would do it? Then the servants would attack, and we'd defeat them, hopefully with fewer than 5,000 casualties, then defeat the Mavapanavae, and live happily ever after. Sure, it was gonna be easy. But at least it was the beginning of a plan. I had no clue what the puff was gonna be on an entity that was supposed to be over 100 meters long, but it was sure to be pretty decent. Depending on how many servants and what kind, I suspected we were all gonna be able to retire. Assuming we didn't take 5,000 casualties when we only had a handful of people, this was going to get interesting. When I returned to the library, the guards politely but sternly barred me from entrance. It turned out that when the MCB had realized I'd left the country, they'd asked their British counterparts to monitor my activity. Even though the MCB had a working relationship with MI4, it wasn't like secretive government bureaucracies communicated efficiently. So when MI4 eventually got around to processing their request weeks later, and it was discovered that a suspected cult member had been hanging out in the world's best collection of occult tomes, delving into ancient mysteries, MI4 had shit a brick. Having caused an international incident, it was time to go home. Chapter 6. When I got to the offices after my trip, Milo, Ray, and Earl were all there. I'd called and told them I'd found some information, so they were waiting for the report. So, Earl growled, you found something.
took you long enough.
We lost Evans while you were gone, Ray said. Bit by a shambler.
Evans? I asked. Tall guy? Milo said. Blonde? Used to be with Miami?
Does not ring a bell.
Oh, Colt Python guy?
Probably, Earl said. They starting to blend?
Little bit.
I laid out my notes.
You want some clue about how much fun I had finding all this stuff? Should I talk about my love of ancient Tibetan? And let me be clear that love is used in the most sarcastic of senses, or how much fun it is trying to figure out which particular meaning of a pictogram is intended in Jin dynastic Chinese. I'd say Mandarin or Cantonese, but those are both the equivalent of modern English versus, say, Latin. Or that there are no modern extant copies of anything about this thing, that everything was on old scrolls so worm-eaten and faded, copied and recopied by hand, that I was spending half my time just figuring out what the next letter might mean?
We get it, Earl said. You're smart, and it was tough. Nobody cares.
The thing is definitely an entity created by the great old ones, and it empowers necromancy.
We already were pretty sure of that, Ray said.
There are only three of them ever known to exist. As the Puff Adjuster mentioned, Africa, Indonesia, and Mongolia. There's no record of the one in Africa being destroyed. Possible it was moved over here at some point. Or there might be a seed that came from there. Worth noting there may be another still there. The Indonesian one was killed by a Dutch expedition, presumably. Very little extant information, just a couple of survivors, and I was unable to find the original report.
Just a couple of survivors, Earl said. Out of how many?
Looks like a couple of companies of Dutch East India Marines and about a regiment of local sepoys.
Jesus, Ray said. What got them?
Again, very little information. I pushed the papers his way. Ray didn't have my gift for languages, but he was smart as I was. Using the translated notes, he might come up with something I missed. But here's everything I found.
So undead, Earl said, shrugging. Which we already had. What else is going to try and murder us?
So I went looking for something in Mongolia. A Chinese expedition was sent up into the Hun lands to, quote, fight a great evil. The expedition's size was the equivalent of 2 legions, about 10,000 troops. They got back with about 3,000.
Okay, that's not good, Ray said.
You think? I said.
What period? Ray asked. Oh, Jim. Eastern or Western?
Eastern.
Xu Wu period.
Those were good troops, Ray said. Highly disciplined, experienced, and trained. Pretty serious warriors.
Yep, I said. The loss of most of the expedition, I think, contributed to the Xu Wu turning over power and the demise of the Eastern Jin. But I digress. The main source of information was a third-hand story from the POV of an apprentice to a powerful Tibetan Lama who accompanied the expedition.
Fascinating, Ray said.
Milo looked confused. Earl was annoyed. The expedition had to, again, fight local supporters and a wizard from somewhere to the west. Could have been from anywhere west. Tibetans weren't all up on geography. The Lama found the body of the thing using the rune of Onesh when the supporters were cleared off. They got miners to dig down to it. The Chinese alchemists tried to burn it with fire, but weren't able to do much damage. Sounds like they were using gunpowder. The Lama hit it with some sort of mystic unguents, and that apparently pissed it off. Unguents unclear. Then it raised its servants. Servants also unclear. I'm thinking that's probably the Khufu worm pseudopods. Basically, it wasn't servants, but the worm itself apparently attacking through those. They can stretch out, obviously, for miles. But I could be wrong. It was the second battle that killed most of the expedition. The Lama managed to kill it, but he was killed as well. That part of the scroll was degraded badly. An apprentice survived and brought the story back to Tibet. And be aware, all of this is not nearly as clear in the writings. This is mostly interpretation and guesses. But that seems to be what happened.
Holy shit. Enough already.
Earl sighed, obviously impatient.
Did you get anything solid?
Earl, there is nothing solid about any of this ancient tome shit, okay? I snapped angrily. And I'm getting to it. I worked on this shit for a solid month. Smoke another fucking cigarette and wait.
Earl scowled. Ray and Milo exchanged a nervous glance.
Chad.
Earl stubbed out the end of his cigarette in an ashtray, then set his hands flat on the desk, took a breath, and addressed me in a very calm manner.
I'm gonna state this in a way that you can wrap your big old brain around. I know it's real important for you to feel like the smartest asshole in the room, but I've got work to do. So actionable intel now. History, minutia, trivia, fun time later. Get to the fucking point already.
They had to deal with the local tribe, fierce cannibals, and the necromancers who were using the entity for power. So what caused what casualties is unclear, but when we attack the body, all hell is going to break loose.
Got it,
Earl said, lighting another cigarette. Guy was a freaking chimney.
So find it, drill down, then hit the monster with some mystic crap we don't know, then fight its servants we don't know, but which were badass enough to wipe out an army. Anything else?
There's a large contingent of Tibetans out in Colorado. I could go see their shamans with my notes and see if they know what unguents to use.
Do it. You may annoy the hell out of me sometimes, but you're good at that kind of thing.
We're going to collect the puff on a 100-plus-meter-old one category entity that has been making it easy to raise the dead and attracting monsters to New Orleans for centuries, I said. I'm thinking we're going to make bank on this, assuming anyone survives.
Assuming MCB doesn't say it's out of our league and take over from us, Ray said.
Then we just don't tell them, I said. Let them go sort through ancient scrolls.
Speaking of MCB... You're still not in the clear there.
I got some thoughts on that in England. I'm going to go see a voodoo woman and try to replicate what MCB did to determine I was a suspect.
You know my opinion on the matter.
Well, you're not the one being hounded by the MCB, and nobody knows where my brother is to straighten this out the old-fashioned way. I'll leave it to the hoodoo lady to figure that out. Maybe I can get enough information from her to show MCB how their casting was misinterpreted. Or at least get that to the political side to start to pull some of the heat off.
Never trust a politician or a wizard.
There's two kinds of trust, Earl, I said, looking him in the eye. One is honesty. The other is competence. There are very few people I trust on both. I can count on the thumbs of one hand the number I trust on both. And I'm including myself in that number.
You don't trust me?
Milo said. We were driving back from clearing some shamblers out of a cemetery. In deference to MCB's new policies, we'd kept it discreet. Agent Robinson was easily excitable, and I was tired of getting arrested. If it came down to me or the Shackelfords, who would you choose? I asked. You don't have to answer, but it's one of the bases. I love you like a brother, Milo. A real brother, not my shithead brother. But totally trust you? I don't actually totally trust me.
Are you honest?
Sure. As honest as anyone can be. But try to honestly answer the original question. Are you always competent? In ways that amaze even me. But I wouldn't want you to represent me in court. And there are emotional connections that you have that are stronger than your connection to me. Would you do something for me, something very important, if you thought it violated your faith or your soul? I would hope not. If Earl was dead set against it? I think you'd tend to take Earl's side. I don't mind that. I don't like you less for it. But you can see where I don't trust you entirely thereby.
I guess there's some logic, Milo said, frowning.
But it isn't about loyalty as much as it is about right and wrong. Mostly it sounds like you trying to justify being a butthead.
Uncool, man. Now, I'm gonna go do some stuff that will make you uncomfortable, I said, pulling up to the team shack. So I'm gonna go do it alone. Because I don't trust you not to say something that will cause an issue. What are you gonna do? I'm gonna go see a voodoo lady, and get my future read in tea leaves and tarot cards, and there might be a chicken sacrificed. Those people are... Milo grimaced and started to get out. Whatever. Milo, I held up my hand. You really are the closest person I have to a brother, so please be aware. The reverse is not true. I'd literally give up my soul for yours. I don't, Milo said, then shrugged. That isn't how souls work anyway. I doubt it will ever be an issue, but I gotta go get my voodoo on. See ya, brother. I went to see my real estate agent. Madam Courtney was a revered hoodoo lady, but her hoodoo had always been of the white. When I'd first met her, I had not realized just how respected she was in the hoodoo world. She made charms and healing potions, cast blessings and such. She'd never been known to lift a finger in harm against anyone. It should be noted that, despite being hoodooed, Madam Courtney attended Catholic Mass every Sunday, without fail, as well as on major saints' days and at various other times. She had, in addition, attended Sunday school every week her entire life. Not with few exceptions. She'd once attended Sunday school and church while suffering from raging pneumonia. So, I couldn't imagine a better hoodoo woman to see to determine what MCB had found out, and possibly more. When I'd said there were 20 wizards in New Orleans better than MCB's, I was serious, and was friends with one of the top three, and her office was conveniently located in Bayou St. John. The place was covered in charms and hoodoo decorations. After her attractive young secretary led me back through the bead curtain, Madam Courtney came around her desk to give me a hug. As usual, she was dressed in bright colors and wearing a bunch of jewelry and amulets. Oliva Chadwicka Denye, my favorite client. Sit, sit. Now, what is the bother for you? I need you to talk to your Lois. The first few times I had met her, Madam Courtney had constantly admonished me to trust in the Loas. It is serious, then, she asked as she returned to her chair. Without asking if I wanted one or not, she poured two glasses from a bottle of dark rum. I have come under suspicion by the authorities of being involved in a very foul crime. They won't give me details, but I've determined they were looking for those who are involved and did some sort of casting. I was found to be connected, as was my brother. The problem being, I am not involved in any way that I am aware. I swear this to you, Madam Courtney.
No need. I know you too well to believe such things.
But the casting has me as being, according to them, the Alpha and Omega. That I created it, and that I can end it. I swear I did not create it, though I would like to end it.
What is this foul crime? Madam Courtney asked.
There is a group who are kidnapping girls to be used as virgin sacrifices and selling them to those of the dark and the black who need such. They often kill whole families to get girls who are the right type. The only information I have is that they're called the Dark Masters.
Ah, you've heard of them.
I wasn't surprised. Madam Courtney knew everybody.
Rumors only. They are not from around here. They work up north and out west. Yankees and scoundrels. So foul with the black that I'm surprised they can maintain the semblance of being human. They call themselves Dark Masters, as they think they are more powerful than the Loas. They revel in sin. Many in this town work with the dark and the black. But I would have no clue, though, why anyone would put you in their midst.
That's the question I've been asking everyone. The only thing I can think is to... The term I'd use is reverse-engineer the casting. To try to do the casting that whoever the feds hired did,
and see what comes of it.
But you know not what casting, Madam Courtney said, frowning.
And it could be many. It depends on what they were looking for.
Could there be a way to look for the girls instead? That may have been what they were doing.
Could a federal hoodoo man have tried to find who took them and somehow my name came up by mistake?
To find the girls, or them as took them.
I'd need something of theirs. Not just something they touched, something that is of them.
Hair, toenails.
Do you have such?
Not currently. I can possibly find something, but that victim would probably already have passed on.
Such a thing is vile,
Madam Courtney said angrily.
Find me something of one of the girls who was took. We will trust the Loas to show us the way.
Thank you, Madam Courtney. I truly appreciate the help. I got up, laid an envelope on the table, and let myself out. When it came to the hoodoo side of her business, you didn't ask Madam Courtney how much her help cost. It cost what you paid. If you had nothing, she would help you for free. If you were rich, you were expected to pay as much as was reasonable. The envelope contained $10,000. I was pretty sure she'd give most of it away to the needy anyway. Chapter 7. Unfortunately, this necessitated another out-of-town trip. Franklin was not happy to see me leaving town again, especially with being down a body again and me being the hunter most familiar with New Orleans, but I had a job to do. I was going to get my name cleared one way or another. My files on the Virgin Kidnappings ring went back to when I was still in good graces with the FBI. MHI had gotten a few of the files on the remaining missing after we rescued those girls from the Seattle Lich. I was virtually guaranteed all of those girls were already sacrificed, but it was the only thing I had to go on. The nearest suspected victim where the family was still alive was in Arkansas. But there was an event in Pueblo that fit the M.O., and while that wasn't close to Crestone, nothing was close to Crestone, it was closer than, say, Arkansas. And Crestone was the Tibetan town I needed to visit to see about what unguents you use to wipe out an old one's entity. Also, I had an inn in Pueblo. It was good to be armed again. The one problem with visiting England was being continuously at the mercy of whatever evil thing might pop up at any time. They had arms at the Institute, but God help you if you were caught walking around Oxford with a 1911 in your waistband. English politicians were firm believers that everyone should be a victim, and English constables looked at carrying a pistol as equivalent to a thermonuclear device. I hired a plane. Less hassle that way. Not a jet. I wasn't going to spend that much. A twin-engine Beech. Faster than driving. And I could load up as many guns as I wanted. I told the pilot I was going big game hunting. Which was almost the truth. First stop was Crestone. Going to Pueblo was going to dredge up old memories. Victims, families, mine. Crestone was easier. Crestone, Colorado is even more the definition of middle of nowhere than Yuma, my late friend Jesse's hometown. It was damn near the center of Colorado, but on the far side of the Front Range from Denver and most of the main areas of CO and in, if not Colorado's most arid region, then pretty darn close. Put it this way, the nearest major attraction was Great Sand Dunes National Park. It was an old mining town that had just about dried up and drifted away with the sand dunes until the 1950s. Them damn Chaikoms had taken over China, then invaded Tibet, then promptly burned 6,000 years of history. There wasn't much the U.S. government could do about China, but they could try to start an armed rebellion in Tibet. Tibet had been independent for as long as anyone could remember, and they'd stayed that way by not only being hard to access, but being good fighters. So, train up some Tibetans and send them back to train others. Set up an airlift like they'd done for the Chinese in World War II. Made perfect sense. Where to put these Tibetans where they'd be at home and
keep their lungs ready for the heights while training. When they activated the Army's 10th Mountain Division, nobody, and I mean nobody, could figure out why the hell they'd put it in New York when they had Colorado just sitting there. The answer, of course, was there was this congressman